Welcome to New World Notes, edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Scott Noble of Metanoia Films has a new documentary out, and it's a good one. It's called Lifting the Veil. And as usual, he's giving it away for free on the internet. It's about 800 megabytes long in MPEG 4 format, but well worth the trouble to download or view online as the spirit moves you. You can find it at www.metanoia-films.org. That's spelled M-E-T-A-N-O-I-A. You'll find a link on our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. We've played parts of a Scott Noble documentary before, Human Resources. This became the basis of two shows in recent months, Controlling the People, 1 and 2. Lifting the Veil is at least as good as Human Resources, maybe even better. It's about all that's wrong with American politics and society. We'll play just parts of that two-hour documentary today. We'll start with Scott Noble's collage of Obama campaign rhetoric. It begins and ends with parts of Obama's victory speech the night he won the election. In between are a number of promises made during the campaign. The collage is hard to listen to because Americans so deeply yearn for and so deeply need the changes Obama promised. Ending the war in Iraq, closing Guantanamo, stopping torture, bailing out the people instead of billionaire bank directors, halting massive wiretapping of citizens. Obama's promises are clear, unequivocal, and forceful. And he broke every single one of them. Following the collage, some very good commentators analyze how the entire U.S. political system is controlled by big money. Office holders inevitably end up serving the interests of their big money patrons, which are generally opposed to the interests of everyone else. The segment ends with an update showing how life for most Americans has gotten worse, not better, since Obama took office in January 2009.
And there he is, President-elect Barack Obama.
It's the answer told by lines that stretched around schools and churches in numbers this nation has never seen, by people who waited 3 hours and 4 hours, many for the first time in their lives, because they believed that this time must be different, that their voices could be that difference.
I will promise you this, that if we have not gotten our troops out by the time I am president, it is the first thing I will do. I will get our troops home. We will bring an end to this war. You can take that to the bank.
When I promise that we are going to bring this war in Iraq to a close in 2009, I want the American people to understand that I opposed this war in 2002, 2003, 4, 5, 6, and 7, so you can have confidence that I about ending this war.
Iran, they spend 1/100th of what we spend on the military. Iran, Cuba, Venezuela, these countries are tiny compared to the Soviet Union. They don't pose a serious threat to us.
I think it's time for us to end the embargo on Cuba. And I think that we have to end it because if you think about what's happening internationally, our planet is shrinking. And our biggest foreign policy challenge and it feeds into directly into the battle on terrorism, and it feeds into issues of trade and our economy, is how do we make sure that other countries, in developing nations, are providing sustenance for their people, human rights for their people, a basic structure of government for their people that is stable and secure so that they can be partners in a brighter future for the entire planet.
Close down Guantanamo, restore habeas corpus, say no to renditions, no to wireless wiretaps.
I have said repeatedly that I intend to close Guantanamo, and I will follow through on that. I've said repeatedly that America doesn't torture, and I'm going to make sure that we don't torture. Those are part and parcel of an effort to regain America's moral stature in the world.
And as president, I'm going to make it impossible for congressmen or lobbyists to slip pork barrel projects or corporate welfare into laws when no one's looking. Because when I'm president, meetings where laws are written will be more open to the public. No more secrecy. That's a commitment I make to you as president. When there's a tax bill being debated in Congress, you will know the names of the corporations that would benefit and how much money they would get. And we will put every corporate tax break and every pork barrel project online for every American to see. You will know who asked for them, and you can decide whether your representative is actually representing you.
Now we're building solar panels and wind turbines and the fuel-efficient cars of tomorrow. Jobs that will help us end our dependence on foreign oil and may save the planet from
theory that says we should give more to billionaires and big corporations and hope that prosperity trickles down on everybody else. The last thing we can afford is 4 more years where no one in Washington is watching anyone on Wall Street, because politicians and lobbyists killed common sense regulations. Those are the theories that got us into this mess. They haven't worked, and it is time for change, and that's why I'm running for president of the United States of America. Bail out Wall Street banks. As president, I will ensure the financial rescue plan helps stop foreclosures and protects your money instead of enriching CEOs. And I'll put in place the common sense regulations that I've been calling for throughout this campaign so that Wall Street can never cause a crisis like this again. That's the change we need. It's been a long time coming. But tonight, because of what we did on this day, in this election, at this defining moment, change has come to America.
It is absolutely true that NAFTA was a mistake.
A senior member of the Obama campaign called the Canadian government within the last month to say that when Senator Obama talks about opting out of the free trade deal, the Canadian government shouldn't worry. The operative said it's just campaign rhetoric and don't take it seriously.
The Canadian government put out a statement indicating that this was just not true. So I don't know who the sources. It wasn't true.
Amid all of the denials, sources at the highest level of the Canadian government who first confirmed that a call was made, late this afternoon, reconfirmed that a call was made.
That was a balloon being popped. And here's William Robinson, editor of Critical Globalization Studies.
how in the world are we going to speak about democracy when a tiny portion of society controls the financial and the material resources of society? How can you have a democratic system? For instance, the United States is the best example. If 1 or 2 or 3% of the population has the vast majority of wealth in society, how can you have a democracy? Because economic power is translated into political influence. That's been a lesson throughout history. So in the United States, the mechanism is that the wealthy and the powerful are able to finance electoral campaigns. If you want to be a viable candidate in any major election in the United States, you need vast resources. You need millions and millions of dollars. The last elections, how many hundreds of millions of dollars were spent by each candidate in the last presidential elections? And unless you're independently wealthy, like Ross Perot, and you have your own hundreds of millions of dollars to invest, you need to turn to those in society that can supply these resources. You need to turn to the wealthy and the powerful. And that means that you subordinate your program to the needs of the wealthy and the powerful. That's the particular mechanism in the United States. But wherever we look in the world, we see that economic power translates into political influence.
In order to have a proper appreciation of the American economic system, we must know how the national income is divided in America.
Political scientist Michael Parenti.
In the plutocracy, those very wealthy people, those one, it's about 0.04, one fraction of 1%. It's less than 1%. When you hear, oh, the top 1% owns 40%, it's less than 1%. It's about 145,000 individuals. They make up this super rich class. You know, Gore Vidal was telling us that when Ronald Reagan went rushing over to the Bohemian Grove and said, I want to crack at the presidency now. I'm governor of California. It's my time. They said, no, Ronnie, you got to wait. It's 1972, that's going to be tricky, Dick. Richard Nixon, he stepped back. He wasn't going to take on the power of the wealth. He's serving that power.
Mr. Reagan is for freedom, and he is for the people.
When people talk about the rich in this country, they really don't seem to have any idea how rich the rich really are. The very top is that fraction I just said of 1%. That's where it goes off the charts. The analogy is that if we could represent our income and wealth by playing blocks, children's playing blocks, each block represents $1,000, most of us would have a pile that would go up maybe anywhere from 6 to 10 or 15 feet at most. But for that top super rich, this is Heilbronner's analogy, the piles of blocks would go up many times over the Eiffel Tower, many times higher than the Eiffel Tower. It would go out of sight.
Concentrations of wealth and power are fundamentally anti-democratic. That whenever you've got a monarchy or a giant corporation like the East India Company, you have a force within society that's going to dominate and dictate and control. Today, you know, we live in a society that is probably more economically stratified than any other country in the world. Literally, 2 or 3% of wealthy Americans own and control probably 80% or more of everything worth owning in our country. And we've seen how these pro-corporate political policies over the last 20 years are really coming home to roost. The middle class has been decimated, and the super rich have done quite well. In fact, only the super rich have really done quite well. Fundamentally, I think the problem here is that we have this system in the United States of politics that is beholden to private money. And even a candidate like Barack Obama, who campaigned as a change agent and actually did get a record number of contributions from small average Americans, managed at the same time to get a record amount in contributions from the biggest interests out there, the insurance industry and Wall Street in particular. And when your political system depends on who can pour the most money into essentially TV propaganda, TV ads, and that's really the biggest determinant in the race, can you hire the best marketers and PR people and advertisers, and can you raise enough money to really run a campaign that's going to overwhelm the airwaves? If you can do that, your odds of winning are probably about 4 or 5 to 1.
Larry Pinkney of Black Agenda Report.
As to him being a phenomenon, the only phenomenon that Obama was a creation and manipulation of the media. He was a brand. The Obama brand. He is a creation and continues to be a creation slash manipulation of the corporate media. Let us be honest about that. Hope, how dare that word be used and distorted the way the Obama brand has used it and distorted it.
Noam Chomsky.
The advertising industry gives a prize every year for the best marketing campaign of the year. 2008, they gave it to the Obama campaign, who beat out commercial competitors. The idea is we market candidates the same way we market toothpaste or lifestyle drugs or automobiles. Of course, it helps to have a lot of money. And in fact, Obama greatly outspent McCain, not because of popular contributions. It came mostly from financial industries. He was their candidate. And his policies will presumably respond to his constituency.
Years later. In September 2010, the Census Bureau reports that U.S. poverty rose to 43.6 million people, an increase of 3.8 million in the past year. It is the largest total since the first 1959 estimates. According to the Economic Policy Institute, 1 in 4 American children now lives in poverty. For blacks, it's well over 1 in 3, and for Hispanics, nearly the same. November 23, 2010. The New York Times reports that corporations have earned record profits in the past years, recording their, quote, best quarter ever, unquote. We'll soon hear from Chris Hedges on the importance of average citizens nonviolently resisting their oppression and their government's oppression of others. But as a preface, the movie first quotes John Pilger's 2009 speech in San Francisco. We broadcast the speech a few weeks back. Here's a bit of John Pilger.
As I believe, something is stirring in this country. Look at the polls. More than 2/3 of Americans say the government should care for those who cannot care for themselves. 64% would pay higher taxes to guarantee health care for everyone. 60% are favorable towards unions. 70% want nuclear disarmament. 72% want the U.S. completely out of Iraq, and so on and so on. Ordinary Americans for too long have been misrepresented by stereotypes that are contemptuous. The progressive attitudes of the public are seldom reported in the media, because they're not ignorant, they're subversive. They are ordinary people who belong to no elite and who judge their government in moral terms, though they would call it common decency. They are not vain. They are the people with a wakeful conscience, the best of American citizens. Sure, they disappear from view now and then, but they are like seeds beneath the snow. The American populace were far from perfect, but they often spoke for ordinary people, and they were betrayed by leaders who urged them to compromise and merge with the Democratic Party. That was long ago, but how familiar it sounds. My guess is that something is coming again. The signs are there. Noam Chomsky is right when he says that mere sparks can ignite a popular movement that may seem dormant. No one predicted 1968. No one predicted the fall of apartheid, or the Berlin Wall, or the civil rights movement, or the great Latino rising of a few years ago. What Obama and the bankers and the generals and the IMF and the CIA and CNN and BBC fear is ordinary people coming together and acting together. It's a fear as old as democracy, a fear that suddenly people convert their anger to action, as they've done so often throughout history.
December 16, 2010. Hundreds of war veterans chain themselves to the White House fence in one of the largest acts of civil disobedience by American citizens in many years. The event is blacked out by the corporate news media. Sidebar comment: the video clips show a march and rally and the civil disobedience and police dragging some of the protesters off to jail. Several of the protesters are men in their 50s and 60s. They're veterans of the Vietnam War, God bless them. It's snowing. The words we'll hear on Hope are by columnist and former New York Times war correspondent Chris Hedges. You may recall Hope as an Obama campaign slogan. Hedges spoke near the White House fence just before he chained himself to it.
Hope will only come now when we physically defy the violence of the state. All who resist, all who are here today, keep hope alive. All who succumb to fear, despair, and apathy become an enemy of hope. They become, in their passivity, agents of injustice. If the enemies of hope are finally victorious in this nation, the poison of violence will become not only the language of power, but the language of opposition. And those who resist here today with nonviolence are the last thin line of defense between a civil society and its disintegration. Hope has a cost. Hope is not comfortable or easy. Hope requires personal risk. It is not about the right attitude or peace of mind. Hope is action. Hope is doing something. The more futile, the more useless, the more irrelevant and incomprehensible an act of rebellion is, the faster and more potent hope becomes. Hope knows that an injustice visited on our neighbor is an injustice visited on all of us. Hope posits that people are drawn to the good by the good. This is the secret of hope's power. Hope demands for others what we demand for ourselves. Hope does not separate us from them. Hope sees in our enemy our own face. Hope is not for the practical and the sophisticated, the cynics and the complacent, the defeated and the fearful. Hope is what the corporate state, which saturates our airwaves with lies, seeks to obliterate. Hope is what this corporate state is determined to crush. Be afraid, they tell us. Surrender your liberties to us so we can make the world safe from terror. Don't resist. Embrace the alienation of our cheerful conformity. Buy our products. Without them, you are worthless, become our brands. Do not look up from your electronic hallucinations, no. Above all, do not think, obey. The powerful do not understand hope. Hope is not part of their vocabulary. They speak in the cold, dead words of national security, global markets, electoral strategy, staying on message, image, and money. The powerful protect their own. They divide the world into the damned and the blessed, the patriots and the enemy, the privileged and the weak. They insist that extinguishing lives in foreign wars or in our prison complexes is a form of human progress. They cannot see that the suffering of a child in Kandahar or a child in the blighted urban pocket of our nation's capital diminishes and impoverishes us all. They are deaf, dumb, and blind to hope. Those addicted to power, enthralled by self-exaltation, cannot decipher the words of hope any more than most of us can decipher hieroglyphics. Hope to Wall Street bankers and politicians, to the masters of war and commerce, is not practical. It is gibberish. It means nothing. And this is because they kneel before the idols of greed and money. If we resist and carry out acts, no matter how small, of open defiance, hope will not be extinguished. If all we accomplish today is to assure a grieving mother in Baghdad or Afghanistan, a young man or woman crippled physically and emotionally by the hammer blows of war, that he or she is not alone, our act will be successful. But hope cannot be sustained if it cannot be seen. Any act of rebellion, any physical defiance of those who make war, of those who perpetuate corporate greed and are responsible for state crimes, anything that seeks to draw the good to the good, nourishes our souls, and holds out the possibility that we can touch and transform the souls of others. Hope affirms that which we must affirm. Defenseless under the night, our world in stupor lies. Yet dotted everywhere, ironic points of light flash out. Wherever the just exchange their messages, may I, composed like them of Eros and of dust, beleaguered by the same negation and despair, show an affirming flame.
Thanks for listening. New World Notes comes to you from WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. NewWorldNotes.blogspot.com. You'll get to my non-carborundum, and ciao. Austerity with sweat at the boundary between the wars. I paid the union and